Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon. We open our phone lines and take your calls if you have questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith, or if you have different viewpoints from those of the hosts and want to discuss those differences. You're welcome to do so here, and you only need to call this number, 844-484-5737. If you'd like to be on the show, certainly calling this early in the show, you will definitely get on the air in the hour that we have before us. If you call later in the show, you might or might not, because sometimes the lines fill up and stay full. Right now, we have at least two phone lines still open. And if you call now, you will definitely get on the program. If you call once the lines are full and you get a busy signal, just try again once one of the callers has moved on, and we'll have lines opening up periodically throughout the program. So here's the number you'll need. It's 844-484-5737. Our first caller today is Ward, calling from Eugene, Oregon. Ward, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thanks, Steve. It's me again.
Yeah.
I don't want to wear out my welcome here, but thanks for taking my call. I kind of want to work backwards quickly as I can. In 1 Corinthians 11:7, Paul says, man was created in the image and for the glory of God, but woman was created for the glory of man. Then in Genesis 1, it says, let us make man in our image. And so he said, so man was made in the image and for the glory of God. And then the verse that threw me is it says that he created them male and female. He created them. So is that kind of a summation or an overview? Because Paul and earlier in Genesis, it appears as though Adam was created first in the image of God, and then a long time later, Eve was created and out of the rib for man's glory in quite a different capacity. And so there is a lot of talk now about equality and equal authority and equal in creation, equal in glory reflectors, both men and women. Are they absolutely equal, or is there some distinction quite different in authority and position between man and woman?
Well, Genesis 1:26 and 27 talks about God making male and female. When it talks about him making man, it does not distinguish between the time of making man from woman, although it does not necessarily say that he'd made them both at the same moment. It just tells us that on the sixth day he made them, and he gave them dominion over everything. Well, chapter 2, as you point out, points out that there was a creation of man, apparently earlier on the sixth day, and then God brought the animals to man for him to name, and then later woman was made and given to man, brought to man as a wife, and they became one flesh. And so what we have in chapter 2 is a more detailed account of the creation of man and woman, whereas in chapter 1 of verse 26 and 27 it just says God made them, he made male and female. Well, of course he did. And we're told more details about how that came about in chapter 2. Now, as far as equality and glory and so forth, I don't know what Paul means when he says that man is in the image and glory of God. The translation you were reading said made for the glory of God, and the woman was made for the glory of man. That may be the correct interpretation, but it's not exactly how it's worded in Paul. Paul says that man is the image and glory of God. Woman is the glory of man. Now, in the Old Testament, it says that the glory of fathers is their children's children. And it sounds like it's saying that grandfathers take great delight in their children's children, that is, in their grandchildren. That the glory, they like to boast about them. They are proud of their grandchildren. Their grandchildren are their glory. Now, to say that would not be the same thing as saying that grandchildren are made for the glory of the grandparents. That would be a slightly different statement. To say that man is the image and glory of God, in the sense that the Bible says elsewhere that grandchildren are the glory of their grandparents, could simply mean that man, the creation of man, was something that God was proud of, that he boasts about. He made a child in his own image. And that doesn't mean he wouldn't be proud of woman also, but woman was made specifically to be the delight of the man, because it was not good for man to be alone. God had made man, but man was not complete without a woman. And therefore, it says, it was God said, it's not good for man to be alone. I'll make him a helper fit for him. And so he made a woman to be the delight and the glory, the pride, as it were, of her husband. Now, that would suggest that a man values his wife, takes delight in her, boasts about her. And certainly this is what we see as the ideal case in Proverbs 31, where it says the husband and the children rise up and call her blessed, mm-hmm. and they say, many daughters have done virtuously, but you exceed them all. The norm is for a married couple to have such a relationship that the husband just admires and adores his wife. And to say that the woman is the glory of the husband, the wife is the glory of the husband, would be perhaps saying something like that, rather than simply saying that the wife exists for the glory of her husband. Now, on the other hand, I would not deny a statement that the wife may be for the glory of her husband. It certainly is the case that man is for the glory of God. But again, Paul's statement is ambiguous enough that it's not clear right. how it is said. As far as the roles go, however, it says in 1 Peter chapter 3 that husbands should give their wives honor as the weaker vessel and as being heirs together of the grace of life. Now, the husband and wife are joint heirs together. They participate together as partners in the task that God has given them and in the privileges of life. And a man is supposed to honor his wife. It does say she's the weaker vessel, and some women might object to being called weaker, since some women have big muscles and big bodies and maybe a lot stronger than some little wimpy guys. But, of course, Paul's not talking about necessarily muscular strength when he talks about, although he could be, and because in most cases, most men are physically stronger than most women, though you'll find exceptions. I think he's talking about some other kind of weakness. I think he's talking about a certain fragility, a certain delicateness mm-hmm. That women possess, which isn't so commonly the case with men. Now, there are exceptions in every case. There are some women who aren't very delicate and some men who are. But in general, women have, they're more easily offended in many cases. They hold an offense longer and so forth. And this is not a criticism. This is just an observation. Anybody who's observed relationships between women and relationships between men will recognize instantly that most men can insult each other, can even get into fist fights with each other, and the next day they can be buddies again. Women, on the other hand, they get injured emotionally, and they're much more fragile in that respect. Now, if any woman is listening to me who's an exception to this rule, I admit there are some exceptions. But I think anyone who's not trying to push some kind of an egalitarian agenda would have to say that observation proves that women do have somewhat more delicate emotional makeup than men often do. Now, delicate doesn't mean that's not a criticism. China, that is the china in a china cabinet, is far more delicate than the Corel ware in the cupboard. And because it is more delicate, it's actually more valuable. And it is treated with greater deference. You'll treat your china, your heirloom china, far more carefully and with more respect than mm-hmm. you will treat your Corel ware, you know, or your Tupperware. And that's what Paul says about in a great house, there are vessels that are for honor and vessels that are not used for honorable purposes. And Peter says we honor our wives because they are weaker, or I would take that to mean in the sense of somewhat more delicate than men. You treat a light bulb with greater care than you treat an anvil, you know, because it's weaker, it's more delicate, it's more easily broken, and so you handle it with care. And I believe that that's what the Bible is teaching there. I don't think it's saying that men are more valuable than women.
No.
there certainly are different roles that God has given men and women, because essentially because of the delicateness, the difference in that, in general, God has usually used men to be in the positions where they take the brunt of social conflict. No doubt this is why men are given the leadership in the home and in the church, and usually in society too, because the man who's the leader is going to get the criticism and the attacks and all those things, and a woman is to be protected by her husband. I know this sounds very old-fashioned and probably very chauvinistic, but it's not. It's just realistic. I mean, just because our whole society has gone over to a totally egalitarian pretense that men and women are no different from each other doesn't mean that thinking people are required to go along with the lemmings in our society. Anyone who is thinking rationally can see there is a difference between most men and most women. Although, of course, the past generation or two, there's been a strong social conditioning trying to change that, trying to affirm a more effeminate man and a more masculine woman. And no doubt that social conditioning has had some effect on the way men and women feel about genders and about themselves. But it's not working completely. Some of the most feministic women I know still exhibit the easily offended delicacy of their emotions that I'm talking about. You know, social conditioning doesn't change what you are wired to be in many cases. So anyway, I believe that man and woman are of equal value. I believe they are heirs together of the grace of life. They share in the same privileges. That doesn't mean they share in the same functions. A man doesn't get to have the babies, and a woman doesn't do all the same things a man does in certain realms. Maybe she can in some cases. Maybe she can fill in the emergency, just like a man can become a surrogate. You know, he can be Mr. Mom and stay home if there's no woman in the house. But ideally, you know, God has designed it for women to do the mothering and for men to do the protecting and providing. That exceptions exist, I wouldn't deny. But that they are exceptions, I would insist upon.
Well, again, thank you very much, Steve, for that insight.
Okay, Ward, thanks for your call. Mm-hmm. God bless you.
Bye.
Bye now. Okay, our next caller is Don from Vancouver, Washington. Don, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi, Steve. Hey, I try not to call too often because I don't want to use up the airtime. But you had a person from this area, a Constantine, yesterday call and ask about missions, short-term missions specifically. Remember that call?
Somebody was asking about missionary work, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. And just that within the missionary realm, there's actually a lot of debate going on right now. But he was actually very right what he was saying. Short-term missions are almost always mainly a waste of resources, money, time, but often, too, they're actually counterproductive in what they're trying to do. There's and that's because of a lot of different reasons. It'd take a long time to explain it. But it's the short-term missions industry is what I'll call it. It's turned to almost missionary tourism. Now yeah. I'm you know me. You've heard me talk about perspectives and everything. I believe in missionary work, but short-term missions are usually not a good way to accomplish what we're trying to do within the for God's kingdom. And there's a couple of primers books people can look at if they want to. One is called Giving Wisely, and another one is called When Helping Hurts. And those will just give you some ideas of why these are the truth. You can actually go online and research it and find out, too. But there's actually an industry now, and there's a lot of momentum to keep short-term missions happening, but they're almost always not a good idea.
All right. Well, I'm not gonna refute that. I have long felt that the modern American missionary philosophy is very different than that of the Bible. But I'm not sure that we are required in every respect to imitate the missionary activity of the Bible, since we don't have the same kind of apostles to do the work as they had. I mean, sometimes we have to do some modification of policy when we don't have the same kind of resources. But in general, we don't find short-term missionaries being sent out in the Bible. Although, of course, the apostles sometimes remained only short-term in a certain place. They were on the mission field long-term, but they were often, you know, moving around so that they were really only short-term in certain areas. But they did maintain, even when they left an area, like when Paul left Corinth after 18 months, he maintained correspondence and oversight of them. So he hadn't really left them entirely. They were still under his care. But the main thing I would think is different is that we often want to send out as missionaries the youngest, most zealous, the most available, because in natural thinking, that'd be the group most to be sent, because they don't have, they're not married yet, they don't have their careers yet, they may be between high school and college, they're zealous, they're energetic, you know, it seems like a great group of people to send out as short-term missionaries. But in the New Testament, they only sent out their best men. And sometimes if a person went out who wasn't one of their best men, like Mark, he bailed and didn't work out well, and Paul wouldn't take him a second time, because it was their view that the men whom God has called as and made leaders should go out and lead the missionary effort. When Paul and Barnabas were sent out from the church of Antioch in Acts chapter 13, it was the Holy Spirit sent them out after they had been the leaders of the churches of the church in Antioch for about a year.
And the best models sold typically a couple, a married couple over a long term. The missions have changed too. You know, used to the world was fresh. This is a new thing. They hadn't heard of Christianity. But now a lot of the world is hardened to Christianity, and a lot of the world is really, even if they're not hardened to Christianity specifically, they're in such a primitive or in some cases very tough, violent areas that you've got to build long-term relationships, and I wish I could do that. My wife and I are rather old to do that, actually, but we would love to. But that's what it is usually taking. Missions are not just something you do in a few days or even a few weeks. It's a long-term strategy, and it's worldwide. And there's a lot of mistakes made, a lot of things we're learning. But and actually, all I'm saying is people hear this, and they'll hear this. A lot of times young people, too, are sent because churches believe you'll get them on fire. And that there is a correlation between going on a short-term mission and zealousness for missions, but now they're thinking that's not a causative relationship, but more of a correlative. In other words, people who might have had that fire lit will have it lit anyway, whether they go or not. So there's really not good reasons behind short-term missions, except for very limited. There might be a few, but it's like I heard one person he said 99% of them, at least, and he's an expert in it, said at least that much, are not good to do, either not effective or even counter-effective.
Yeah, I've seen plenty of that myself, I have to tell you.
And they can do the research and see this themselves. I'm just urging people, really, you know, there's a lot of work to do, a lot of things to do, and a lot of good ways to do it, but short-term missions are not the best.
Okay, Don, tell us the names of those two books again, then I got to move along.
Okay, Giving Wisely, and I can't remember the author right now.
Giving Wisely.
And When Helping Hurts.
When Helping Hurts, okay.
And I think that's at Brian Filbert or something like that, a co-author. But he spoke at Mission Connection here a couple of years ago.
All right.
Very good book. Okay?
Thank you, Don.
Oh, thank you, Steve.
Good talking to you.
You.
Bye now. I'm sorry. I'm kind of in the middle of you speaking. I think I hung up. Okay, let's talk to Ken from Albany, Oregon. Ken, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yep. I'd like to hear your opinion on the chorus singing of today. It's so repetitious and loud. Seems like vain repetition to me.
Well, yeah, I don't know that it's... I don't know if we can blame it on choruses per se, but you're right. An awful lot of the singing in churches is... vain, which means empty, repetitious, and loud. Now, let me just say that being loud is not a bad thing in itself. David was pretty loud and recommended loud singing, but loud isn't always appropriate. And yet, you know, many churches have made loud the new normal. You know, it says in the Proverbs, that he that blesses his neighbor with a loud voice rising early in the morning will be counted a curse to him. There's times when a loud voice is okay. There's other times it's not very sensitive. And to tell you the truth, a lot of older people, and I don't know how many younger people, really are not accustomed to having their ears blasted with the maximum volume of amplifiers and so forth, and it's not, it does not it's not conducive to worship. It's distracting, and some churches don't seem to realize that. Of course, most churches are going for the young people. I'm not sure what they're going for the young people to do with them, because in many cases they're not doing much to disciple them. They're certainly not making them more sensitive in many cases to the needs of the older people in the church. And that's me, an old man, being grumpy about it. But I mean, I used to be in a Christian rock band, and we had loud amplifiers. People used to complain about the loudness of our amplifiers. But we weren't playing, we weren't leading worship. We were doing evangelistic music on college campuses and things like that. We were doing concerts, not leading worship. The loud music in worship services today, many times, at least in my experience, when I go, I can't hear if the congregation's singing or not. All I can hear is the voice on the microphone and the musical instruments and the drums. I can't really see how that is conducive to better worship if a person can't even tell if they're singing the notes or not, because they can't hear their own voice coming out of their mouth. And that, this is no exaggeration. Now, maybe some people like that, but it seems to me like that's more for an entertainment venue, or maybe for an outreach venue, than it is for a corporate worship setting. If the congregation can't even tell whether they themselves or their person next to them are singing, why should they even bother? Why should they even bother to sing? Why not just sit down and enjoy the concert if it's enjoyable? As far as the courses being vain repetitions, some of them are repetitious and some of them are vain. Vain meaning empty. There's been a worship music industry that grew up in the 80s and is flourishing still. And it's frankly just, it seems to me that it's more about selling songs than about worshiping God. Now, I'm not denying that some of the people who write these songs might be people who really do worship God and might want other people to do so too. But the fact that these songs are copyrighted and that you can get sued if you sing them without, you know, without paying the proper copyright fees and so forth, and this is true. I mean, this has been done. Churches have been sued because they've used songs which, if you heard, if the writer of the song had stood before you and in a worship leading situation, he probably would have said, "The Lord gave me this song." Well, the Lord may have given it to you, but you're selling it to churches and suing them if they don't pay you. That's not worshiping God. That's worshiping money. And the fact that the whole worship song industry has been commercialized makes me think there's nothing about it that should be encouraged. Now, I believe that worship choruses can be as edifying as hymns. Although, in general, I think anyone would have to admit, if they're familiar with both the modern choruses and the old hymns, the hymns have generally far better content. That is to say, they say things that make sense. They speak of the true, heartfelt worship of real Christians. I mean, there's maybe some hymns that don't do that, but in general, most people who've raised in the church, that is, the church that sang hymns, can probably think of 50 or so hymns that every time they sing them, it just elevates their thoughts truly to the presence of God. And better yet, they even understand what they're saying and can hear their own voices singing them. The worship choruses, an awful lot of them, I can't understand what they're saying. I mean, I'm reading it on the PowerPoint slide, but I don't know what the words mean. If one sentence has a clear meaning, the next one doesn't have a similar meaning. It's like the hymns. You know, like if a hymn has four or five verses, you'll note it follows a theme from the first word of the first verse to the last word of the last verse. It follows a theme. It expresses either a theological or a heartfelt conviction that a true worshiper who knows something about God would actually say and mean. But my impression is an awful lot of the popular worship songs are written by people who either don't know any theology, or don't know what worship is, or simply can't communicate in English, because I have to say an awful lot of it is really, really bad poetry or attempts at poetry. Some of it doesn't even attempt to be poetic. And in many cases, see, what I can't figure out is if I was writing a song, and I'm not a songwriter, if I was writing a song, I'd at least want it to rhyme like music generally is supposed to do, you know, the words. And I would realize that it might be hard to find words that rhyme, that say, you know, exactly what you want to say. And you'd either compromise either on the rhyming or on saying what you want to say. You might choose a line that rhymes but doesn't say exactly what you want to say, but you're doing it for the sake of maintaining a rhyme. Or you do say what you want to say, but you just don't worry about whether it rhymes. The problem I have is in many cases of the courses, as I'm reading them, first of all, they don't rhyme. And secondly, they don't say anything that makes sense. I mean, if you're going to say something that doesn't make sense, at least make it rhyme so that it can sound like a song. But why say something that doesn't make sense anyway? And, of course, a lot of the courses are all narcissistic songs. They're all about me, all about how I feel, what I'm getting out of you, God, and so forth. I mean, this is more worship of self than of God in many cases. Now, I sound pretty critical, I know. And I'm a worship leader myself. I do lead worship in certain meetings, and I do not always use hymns. I do sometimes lead in hymns, but I also have choruses that I think are truly worshipful songs. Very few of them have been written in the last 20 years, however, and many of them are simply the scriptures put to music, and they were put to music back in the 70s, not recently. I have heard more modern choruses, some of them, that are really truly good, so good that I wonder if they're old hymns. There's been a few modern choruses that have been published in recent times that really are beautiful, beautifully crafted, and they say what a Christian really ought to be able to understand and say with conviction. And that's why whenever I hear them, I think, is this really a new chorus or is this an old hymn? Because there are some people who've written some choruses. So I don't want to broad brush them all. I'm talking about the general tendency of an industry, a commercialized industry. Any songwriter who writes a worship song and requires to be paid by the people who sing it is worshiping money. I don't care what they say. They're going to say, I gotta feed my family. Well, so do I, but I don't charge for what I do. I mean, you don't have to charge. Jesus didn't charge for what he did. He told his disciples, freely you've received, freely you give. The disciples didn't charge for what they did. They couldn't. They'd be disobedient to Jesus. And so are you. If God gives you something for the body of Christ and you charge for it, you're disobedient to Jesus. And it's not worship. It's business. And maybe I sound a little blunt, but once in a while I kind of do. If you're selling worship songs and suing people who won't pay you for them, you're in a business. You're not worshiping God. And someday ask me privately, I'll let you know what I really think about this modern worship music when I'm not so restrained. All right, Ken?
Thanks a lot.
All right, I appreciate your call. Okay, let's talk to Roman from Sacramento, California. Roman, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Greg, this is Roman. Give me a call.
Yes.
So my question is, within the last 6 months, I've seen two of my best friends go from church members and Christians to become full-blown atheists. And we've been talking with them numerous times now since they become atheists. And the last talk we had, I couldn't really answer one of their questions. They're asking, if God doesn't want the sinners to perish and go to hell, so why did he order Moses and the Israelites people when they came out of Egypt to kill all the nations around them? Why did God order innocent babies and women to be slaughtered? And then that was not a bad thing, it was a good thing. And nowadays, God is saying something almost totally opposite. So did God change, or what happened here? And I'll go off the phone. Just, if you can, please clarify that.
Okay, Roman, thanks. Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
All right, bye now. Now, I don't understand the question in terms of the first line, the first premise. If God doesn't want people to go to hell, why did he have Israel do such and such a thing? Now, part of the such and such was that he killed innocent babies and women. Well, as I understand it, if somebody who's innocent dies, they're not going to go to hell. Hell is for guilty people. Hell is not for innocent people. And therefore, if any innocent people did die, then God didn't take them to hell. So there wouldn't be a conflict there. Now, if someone says, but why did he even make innocent people die? Well, partly because no one's fully innocent. We're all sinners, and the wages of sin is death, so we all die. you know, those people that weren't killed by the Israelites, that were killed by the Israelites, if they had not been killed by them, they'd have been dead for over, 3,500 years now. And they'd be wherever they are. God has the right, and in fact, one might say the responsibility, to maintain some measure of order and justice in the universe, and he does so. One thing he does is he puts a limit on the tenure of sinful human beings in this world. Now, some of them die young, very young. If they die young enough, I believe they die completely innocent, and I believe they go to be with the Lord. Some of the babies, certainly, maybe all the babies that the Canaanites had that were killed, they went to be in heaven. And you know what? I'll bet if you talk to one of them today, they've got no complaints whatsoever that they got to go to heaven instead of to grow up and worship Molech and go to hell when they died. I don't know. We'll have to ask them about it when we go up there. But we can't assume that they are in any sense disappointed by God's choice in that matter. If there were adults that were innocent, then God will treat them as innocent. You see, the issue is not, did somebody die? Everybody dies. It's not even, did they die by the sword or did they die some other way? Well, there's some ways easier to die than others. Actually, by the sword is a lot quicker and a lot, if I could say so, a lot nicer way to die than some of the protracted, torturous ways that people die at times. In other words, I'm not trying to be insensitive, but let's face it. Let's just be realistic. Everybody's going to die. The real issue is, do they die on good terms with God or not? If God had said, you know, Israel, I'm not going to make you go in there and slaughter the Canaanites. Just go in there and live with them. And then, as God feared, Israel became corrupted by the Canaanites, as he said they would. Well, then what do you have? You have the Canaanites who have died and gone to hell since then, and you'd have the Israelites dying and going to hell since then. Is that really better? Is it better for the Canaanites, whose society was so corrupt that they were sacrificing their own babies to Molech and living in absolute moral degeneracy? Is it really that surprising that God would say, you know what, you people, you guys have really used your tenure on earth very badly, and you've all done things worthy of death, and I'm just going to do the whole world a favor and get rid of you people. Now, that's what God did in the flood. He wiped out the whole world except for Noah and his family. And if someone says, but if God doesn't want people to go to hell, why did he wipe them out in the flood? Well, that's just an issue of timing. They would have died anyway. The real issue is, did they die prepared to meet God or not? My guess is that God would never let somebody die unprepared to meet him if he knew that by letting them stay around, they would soon get right with him and die prepared to meet him. There's just a certain number of people that are not going to come to God in their lifetime. And God's decision of when to end their career of crime and evil, that's his prerogative. Now, your friends who are atheists don't believe there's a God, they say. But suppose there isn't, then they've got nothing to complain about. Because if there is no God, then God didn't do any of the things they're complaining about. Because a God who doesn't exist can't do anything that you'd object to. So they've got to make up their mind. Are they saying there's no God? Or are they saying they don't like the God who exists and who did those things? You can't have it both ways. You can't say there is no God, and I'm really angry at what he did. That's just not one of the options open to rational people. Your friends have to make up their mind. Is there no God? Or are they just angry at God? An awful lot of people who become what they call atheists are not atheists at all. They're just bitter. They're just angry. God has done something they don't understand or they don't approve of, and so they're going to punish him by calling themselves atheists. Well, that's like cutting off your own nose to spite your face. You know, how's God damaged by calling yourself an atheist? If you're not a person who's devoted to him anyway, what does it matter to him whether you're an atheist or something else? If you're devoted to God, then when you find that God has done some things you don't quite understand, your very predisposition of devotion to God tells you, well, God is greater, bigger, more intelligent than I am. I've certainly known him to be more gracious than he needs to be, certainly sending his son to die for the sins of the people who were cursing him and spitting in his face. That certainly is a gracious act on the part of God. If God, who has shown himself to be that gracious, has also done some things that I have a hard time understanding, maybe I should just figure that he's smarter and better than I am, and maybe he has better reasons than he's told me about. And maybe I should be a little more humble and accept the fact that I'm not God. I don't understand things as well as he does. And I'm just not going to get mad at him if he disappoints me, because ultimately he's been better to me than I deserve anyway. And I mean, that's the way a humble person who's devoted to God would think about these things. A person who says, you know, I don't like what God did here. He's got a lot of explaining to do. I'm going to give God an F on this report card. Therefore, I'm going to punish him and call myself an atheist. That person never was devoted to God in the first place. People who are devoted to God don't judge God. They realize they're the ones who will be judged by God, and they should be. He's the righteous and perfect judge. They're not, obviously. So, I mean, the person who's put himself forward as a judge of God is somebody who is not devoted to God. And if a person is not devoted to God, what does God care if they call themselves an agnostic, a Buddhist, or an atheist, whatever you call them? What they, you know, are they punishing him? It's puny man deciding that God had better please me better than he's doing, or else I'll give him something to regret. Oh yeah, well, he's got ways of making us regret what we did too. I don't think a person is wise who decides to make God an enemy. I mean, the Bible says the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. A person who says, if God doesn't please me, I'm going to call myself an atheist, and that'll show him. I'll spit in his face. Okay, you go pull on Superman's cape and spit in the wind if you want to, and you go mess around with Jim. But don't mess around with God. Anyone who does that is about as stupid as any human being I can imagine. At least they're being very stupid at that moment. All right, I appreciate your call very much. Let's talk to Tom from Seattle, Washington. Tom, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yes, hello. Question. there's a growing trend of secularism in the United States and throughout the world. But
yeah, I noticed.
Not that the two are related, but why do you think there's been such an increase in preterism or partial preterism?
Yeah, well, let me ask you why you mentioned secularism in the same word with preterism.
Well, that's what I was trying to be careful about saying.
Yeah.
But
I mean, do you think there's any connection?
Well, I think the connection, if any, would be an intellectual definition more so of what is going on in the Bible as opposed to a spirituality concept.
Well,
toward,
yeah,
which the fundamentalists are often very common at doing, whereas the preterist tends to look at everything from a more literal position and correlating verses historically in both in context.
In other words, the preterists are actually doing theology, whereas the ones who are against preterism are not doing theology. They're letting their teachers tell them what to think about things. And I think that probably does explain the increased interest in preterism today, is that preterism is the view that a person will end up taking if they don't have an agenda otherwise, and if they start looking at the scriptures in their context and saying, wow, Jesus said this would happen, and look, it did happen. Oh, look, Paul said this would happen, it did happen. Oh, look, Isaiah said this would happen, this did happen. Now, see, all Christians do that with some things. When we read in Micah that the Messiah will be born in Bethlehem, oh, look there, it did happen. When we read in Zechariah that the Messiah will come riding into Jerusalem on a donkey, hey, that happened too. Now, every Christian recognizes that. I don't know why they have such a hard time when Jesus says Jerusalem's going to be destroyed and not one stone is going to be left standing on another, and this generation will not pass before it happens. And lo and behold, look, it happened. Why not add that to the things that we glory in about the Bible's perfection? One of the great proofs of the inspiration of Scripture is that God and his spokespersons were able to predict the future before it happened, and then we have confirmation that they were who they said they were, because it did happen. Jesus said to his disciples in the upper room, I tell you these things before they come to pass, so that when they do come to pass, you'll know that I am he. And yet there's many Christians who are so devoted to a man-made system called dispensationalism that, you know, they don't want to see that Jesus predicted something and it happened in the very time frame that he said. In fact, they're emotionally resistant to it. Why? Well, you're right. They're not being very intellectual. They're being emotional. They're not doing the theology. They're supporting something that they've been taught is supposed to be supported, and their teachers are so insecure that they'll say that anyone who doesn't agree with them is a heretic. You know? I mean, isn't that what the dispensational teachers say when they say, oh, preterism, that's a heresy. Really? Can we show that it's a heresy? Can we go to the scripture and show that it's a heresy? Well, no, but it is because it just is so different than what we believe. Okay, so if different from what you believe is what's called heresy, then we'll have to accept your statement on its own merits. But the truth is that as you study the biblical prophecy and you study the fulfillment of prophecy, you'll find that while all Christians recognize some prophecies to have been fulfilled, those who are called preterists are those who have recognized that there's even more prophecies that have been fulfilled than what the popular view would teach. And so that would be I think preterism's growing in interest for that very reason.
I hear what you're saying, and it makes sense to me, but doesn't that also negate both positions that one would say, let's say you say the dispensationalist would take this position and the preterists would take this position? Don't they both negate each other to where, in essence, they both end up losing in terms of reaching
out
to a Christ-rejecting world?
Well, I'm not sure why they'd be losing. The truth shall make you free. So whoever...
Because one disavows the other and vice versa, to where both, in a sense, lose the greater message.
Well, I don't... Are you saying that dispensationalists and preterists, they've lost the message that Jesus is Lord?
No, what I'm saying is that if they're both arguing with each other about, crossing every T, dotting every I, and spiritualism versus literalism, in a sense, it seems to negate the bigger picture, which is...
Well, that'd be a matter of degree. We could say that Martin Luther should never have studied theology. He would have kept Christianity all under the Roman Catholic Pope, and he could have just focused on preaching the gospel and not on fine points of theology.
So where is the middle ground then?
Well, the middle ground is...
Can a preterist meet middle ground with a dispensationalist? Is it possible?
Why should they? Why should they meet in the middle ground? Why shouldn't both sides say, let's discover what the Bible teaches and let's go with that? That's what the preterist is trying to do that I know of. And if a dispensationalist is trying to do that too, who should say they shouldn't? In other words, I don't know if you're saying that the preterist and the dispensationalist should both say, you know, we don't agree, so let's accept half of what you're saying and half of what I'm saying, then we'll be in a middle ground. No, why not just say, when we're talking to non-Christians, we're going to present the gospel to them, because we're supposed to preach the gospel to non-Christians. When we're talking to Christians, we're going to be doing our best to learn what the Bible says, and that means we're going to study it. We're going to study the Bible and see if we can understand what it means. I don't know. Are you saying we shouldn't?
No, I hear what you're saying. I agree with you, and I see it. But I think at the same time, there's this battle going on between the preterists arguing with the dispensationalists, and many times I've listened to your show for a while long enough to realize that you do tend to pick on the dispensationalists. But at the same time, there are dispensationalists who have voiced opinions about preterists of equal value.
Oh yeah! And in fact, I've never said that dispensationalists are heretics. But they'll say preterists are heretics without any conscience.
Say they're heretics, but I have heard you say that they
are wrong.
In so many ways, you've made it clear that dispensationalists are a little bit out there and really aren't facing the true reality of the scriptures.
Well, would Luther be? Would you accuse Luther of having made the mistake in saying that about Roman Catholicism?
Well, I wouldn't accuse Luther of that, but I know Luther.
Are you glad there was a Reformation?
Well, I don't know if that really relates to the discussion we're having.
It does. It does. It's the same point. I want to know: are you glad or sorry that Luther lived and there was a Reformation?
Well, no, I'm not sorry, but there were many things that Luther did were also equally questionable. But
I agree. I agree. That's not what I'm asking. I'm asking, do you think Luther should have just kept his mouth shut and just we could all still be Roman Catholics? Because after all, you don't want to you don't want to tell someone they're wrong.
Well, I think that with the printing of the Bible that eventually came, more and more people would have begun to realize what was going on. Luther just simply was ahead of his time. But
okay, then let's say Luther was never born. Let me ask you this, Tom. Let's say Luther was never born, and the Bible was printed, and so a whole bunch of people throughout Europe began to get the same insights that Luther had. Should they not point out that the Roman Catholic Church was wrong in selling indulgences? Or should they just say, hey, let's just all go get along?
Yeah, but in time that became a consensus that was the case, whether Luther had showed up or not. That became the consensus. The Roman Catholic Church had a hold on the movement. And Luther just happened to be a bannerhead.
But it never became a consensus. To this day, Catholics and Protestants disagree. I guess what I'm asking you is, are you thinking that whatever the prevailing paradigm may be of theology, we should just let it be and never dispute it?
Well, unfortunately, I think that that's kind of what's going on today, in spite of your statement, is that theology is rapidly changing. And the Christian, you just mentioned it a moment ago when you talked about worship music, that there is this sort of falsehood permeating the Christian church, which is a concoction of a lot of things that 20, 30 years ago would have considered to be out of line. I guess I think theology is changing radically.
Should it?
I feel like the church is desperately looking to find a balance between what I referred to a moment ago as the preterist position and the dispensational position.
See, I hope they don't find a balance between the two, because that means they'll have to accept half truth and half error.
Not necessarily. I think spiritualizing the Bible still has a place in our lives, but I also think the preterist position also has a place in our lives. I just, quite frankly, I get a little tired of hearing this war between the partial preterist or the pure preterist versus dispensationalist.
It's
almost laughable.
Yeah, there certainly are places you can avoid if you don't want to hear the conflict. You know, if you don't want to hear the controversy, you don't want to hear the debates, there are places on the web you can avoid. There's places on the radio you can avoid. But there are people out there who actually would like to hear both sides, and they
understood.
would like to make a decision. And if they don't hear this show, they'll have to find someplace else to find it, because it's pretty unusual to find on the radio any kind of a ministry that's not dispensational. But you can find others.
You have a voice. I would agree. Your voice is a voice of reason. But at the same time, you do negate many of the what we've called last days theology, and just kind of throw it out the window. And
well,
for a lot of Christians, there is relevance to what's going on in the world today. But at times, I've heard you talk about it as if it'll all pass, and a lot of it's nonsense.
You're saying I shouldn't say that.
No,
well, what if I'm right?
You should have an open mind to a lot of things.
Hey, listen, I'm a very open-minded person. In fact, the views that I am saying are wrong are the views I believed and taught, and I know all the arguments for them. I did not change my view because I was closed-minded. I changed my view because I was extremely open-minded. I still am. If the dispensationalists want to come up with a new argument that I haven't considered, I'll listen to them. I don't think they have any, because I used to defend dispensationalism for years. And if you know anything about how I do things, I don't do things halfway. I knew every single argument for dispensational interpretations of just about every verse they use, and I did it for years. Now, I'm not saying I'm right and they're wrong because I'm me. I'm just saying I'm open-minded. That's why I changed my mind. If I had any reason to believe that they were equally open-minded, I'd delight in the fact that they were so, because I think that there's some hope for them to see things as they are written instead of as they've been taught to believe them. Now, I can see from your last statement that you're concerned because I say that the last day scenarios, I don't know if you're thinking maybe John Hagee's blood moons theory or whatever, when I say there's nothing to them, that bothers you? What if there is nothing to them? That's the question. If there's nothing to them, am I doing a disservice by pointing that out? Now, if there is something to them, then let the dispensationalists show me. Let anyone who says there's something to them show it in Scripture. Why should we be afraid to have Bibles open on the table in front of us and exegete the actual passages that are the basis for our differences of opinion. Why should that be threatening? Why should that even be considered divisive? I can fellowship with dispensationalists, and I invite them to call me here. I'll have a conversation with them. I'll let them present their views. There's a brother named Dennis who calls, has been calling for years. He used to call himself Dennis the Dispensationalist. He changed his view now. He's a historic premillennialist, but still disagrees with me. And he calls, and boy, I give him a lot of opportunity to share his views and his arguments. There's not very many dispensationalists who want to do that, but they're welcome to. And I don't consider that to be a bad thing. I'm not sure why anyone would feel threatened by it. If what I'm saying is true, then how can you fault me for saying it? And if what I'm saying isn't true, then how can you fault me for inviting people to call and point out that it's not true? My position is wide open.
Well, if you would stop cutting me off, I'd probably respond to some of the things you're
Well,
saying.
I'm sorry. I'm going to cut you off right now because I have to move along. And this is really interesting, Tom, if you're still listening. Maybe you won't. Maybe you'll, out of anger, turn off the radio. When I put a caller on hold so I can speak, I'm doing what I have to do or what I think I have to do. Now, if you want to get your own radio show, then you'll have to do with callers what you think you need to do. But I have to do what I think will benefit the listeners. I give plenty of opportunity for you to make a point, but frankly, you didn't make your point as clearly as I would like you to have. In many cases, I wish the persons who disagree with me would be clearer and make their points better. But the truth is that there are times when I just have to say, okay, it's time for me to say something in response to what you've said. And I am the host of the show, and I feel like it's my responsibility to host the show to the advantage of our listeners. By the way, there are many hosts who wouldn't let anyone get on and defend a view or different than their own. I actually like it when people do, but I like it best if they do it clearly and responsibly, and when I bring challenges that they would answer those challenges and so forth. Anyway, Tom, I'm sorry if I disappointed you by putting you on hold, but any caller who complains about being put on hold apparently isn't understanding what my role here is on the show. You didn't buy the airtime. And if I feel that, what you're saying is you've said it well enough, at least as well as I think you're going to, and I want to respond to it, that's just the kind of executive decisions I have to make. And I get all kinds of calls, and I have to make decisions about them all the time. I'll tell you this, if I get a caller who's very articulate and very convincing and disagrees with me, I'm going to give him a lot of time. I'm not going to cut him off, as long as he lets me speak too. But if he talks over me, well, he's going to get on hold so I can speak as well. That's just the way we roll here. Janet from Paradise, California, we're almost out of time. Can you say something quickly, or do you want us to call tomorrow?
Hello?
Yes, it sounds like you're not going to be able to say it quickly. I'm going to be hearing music in just a moment. Do you want to say something quickly?
Well, I just had a question about the question where women and babies were killed. What about all the animals? Why did God kill all the animals when he went in and wiped out a whole village? Why did he have to kill the animals? I know King Saul was dethroned because he didn't do that. Can you give me a quick answer on that?
Well, I don't really know what God's reasons may have been, but you can't really say that God is somehow unjust by having animals killed. That's what would have happened to them if he hadn't. The Amalekites, the Jews were supposed to kill all their cattle. You know what would have happened if the Jews hadn't? The Amalekites would have killed the cattle. That's what they're there for, So, I'm not sure why God wanted that to be the case, but he did, and I wish I had more time to explore it with you. Maybe you can call back tomorrow, and we can get on this and talk about it a little more. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. We are listener-supported. If you'd like to help us pay the radio time that keeps us on the air, you can write to the Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593, or just go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Let's talk again tomorrow. God bless.